May it please the court, my name is Joe Asbell. As Your Honor said, I'm counsel for Mr. Garcia. My bar registration number is 44586. Your Honor, in granting the trial court's, in trial court in granting the motion for summary judgment filed by the defendant, violated two fundamental principles applicable to summary judgment. First, that all inferences must be drawn in favor, the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which was my client, Mr. Garcia. And second, that summary judgment can involve no credibility inferences. Now, the trial court violated those in three ways I'd like to discuss today. And because he violated those three fundamental principles applicable to summary judgment, this case must be reversed and remanded. The first is the way that the trial court dealt with the stray remarks doctrine. Now, Mr. Garcia testified, and he also stated in his affidavit, that during the interview, which was the sole opportunity for Mr. Wright, the sole decision maker in this case, to make his determination whether Mr. Garcia was suitable for the job, said towards the end of the interview that this job, that I have two supervisory positions available, but this job is intended for someone in high school. Now, we believe that that evidence in of itself is enough to defeat summary judgment. It links a class of individuals, high schoolers, with a characteristic that applies universally to high schoolers, that they're young. And so at least a reasonable jury can conclude based on that fact that there was an animus, an age bias at play here. But the trial court...
Could it have been treated as an experience bias? I understand your argument, but perhaps the person interviewing, Mr. Wright, was thinking, you're overqualified. It isn't a matter of age, but this is a job where we bring people in, they're young, there's a lot of telling them what to do, you've been a supervisor. Is there an innocent explanation that is equal to your age discrimination interpretation?
I think there is another reasonable interpretation that could be drawn from that. And I think that is a great argument for the jury or for the finder of fact. But in summary judgment, all of the inferences have to be drawn in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. So while another interpretation might be present, an innocent interpretation, another one is present here. And that is a job is linked to a class of individuals that are excluded from that position.
Well, Mr. Asbell, let me ask you this question. So taking your argument that it must be inferred in favor of Garcia, mm-hmm. would that not be strong enough to what everyone is conceding is that there was a prima facie case? And then the next question is, if you go two steps down the test, is what was the explanation given for the hiring decision pretext? So can you address it in the context of pretext? Because I don't think anyone's disputing that what happened created a prima facie case.
Yeah, and that's correct, Your Honor. They conceded a prima facie case, and so it is in the issue, the argument before the trial court, and here is the issue of pretext. But still, when I reference a few cases, the Aca case, I think, from the Ninth Circuit. There's also the Jaramillo case from the Tenth Circuit, but both dealt with how can we combat, how can a plaintiff's attorney or employee combat the legitimate non-discriminatory reasons presented. And there's a lot of ways you can do it. And one way you can do it is to show that there is a general bias against younger individuals or older individuals. And so that's where it comes in the context of pretext. Now, certainly there's, because it's susceptible to more than one interpretation, we didn't make the argument this is a direct evidence, but we think it comes pretty close to that. And so a general bias for this position, saying that certain people are excluded from this position solely because of their age is pretext. And a reasonable fact finder could conclude from that statement that the rest of the rationales presented, and there's 20-some of them presented in the second EEOC response, that those were unworthy of belief, which is the standard, of course, for what we have to show them for pretext. But I want to go back to the stray remarks doctrine, because the case cited Abdul Brisson talked about the stray remarks doctrine. And frankly, it's just simply not a stray remark. A stray remark comes from a pretty common sense idea that if a statement is made outside of the context of the decision, perhaps by a non-decision maker, that it's not significantly probative of discrimination. But here we've got the remark made during the actual decision. It's not unrelated in time, and it was made by the sole decision maker. So the trial court committed reversible error there, because this, in discounting that statement by reliance on the stray remarks doctrine, he didn't give Garcia the proper inference to be drawn from that fact.
So it's your position, if the statement is made, say, in this case, during the interview, then that excludes it absolutely from the stray remarks doctrine?
I think so, Your Honor. And again, it's that there has to be a nexus between, and appellants cite a case in the 10th Circuit, I think the Reed case, there has to be a nexus. And certainly when the decision is, when a decision maker makes the stray remark connected to the position in the course of the decision, I can't see how it could be farther from a non-stray remark. So the second thing is the credibility inferences to be drawn in this case. And they shouldn't be drawn in this case in summary judgment, or if drawn at all in favor of my client, Mr. Garcia, the non-moving party. But there were two false statements made in this case, and it's the trial court, it's interesting to see how the trial court relied on both of those statements. Now, my client said in his deposition that he lied when he said that he was laid off from a former position, when in fact he stated in his affidavit, explained the circumstances about how that comment came to be. He stated that he had there was a slip of the tongue, that he didn't really mean he lied as far as being dishonest, but he made a false statement. It was in the heat of the interview. He was asked about a position. They were going down through a series of questions about what your former jobs were. He was asked about it. He said resign, when in fact he was laid off, rather, when in fact he was forced to resign. So that's a false statement. Now, we've got an affidavit that explains it, and we think that the court should have considered that and said, okay, a reasonable fact finder might think that it was an intentional dishonesty, but another reasonable interpretation presents itself, and that is it was simply a slip of the tongue in the heat of an interview.
Mr. Aspel, isn't the relevance, though, of that remark the effect that it would have had on Mr. Wright? Not whether he meant to lie or had a misunderstanding about the question, but he said something false. And so then there would be the reasonable effect on the interviewer. Isn't that really the focus of that issue?
I think that's a good point, Your Honor. I think it gives into the honest belief doctrine that the appellees discuss a lot. And so let's look at the evidence regarding that. You know, is there enough information that a reasonable jury could say, well, Mr. Wright really didn't think that Mr. Garcia lied? And I think that there is here, actually. First of all, Mr. Garcia said that there was no follow-up questions, there was no pause, and, you know, Wright didn't say, are you sure about that? I mean, there was nothing like that. The second thing important is when Mr. Wright responded to the EEO, Mr. Wright did all the responses to the EEOC when Mr. Garcia filed his chart, he was given an opportunity to explain the reasons why he didn't select Mr. Garcia. That wasn't one of the reasons. Now, if this was such an important and powerful reason, this almost the sole reason in the brief relied on very heavily, certainly why would he hide that from the EEOC? It doesn't come up until a year later, in April of 2012, when Wright finally says, as reason number 10 in his list of 20, that this was a part of his decision. So, third, there are no contemporaneous documents. There's nothing written on the resume from Mr. Wright that says, I've got a red flag here. I've got a problem. In other courts, the ACCA court, again, said, well, you would expect to find some notation, something contemporaneous with the interview, suggesting that this was a big concern, if it really was such a primary concern. And so I think all those facts put together, you can say, okay, there's some shifting rationales here. We've got 8 reasons provided. Initially, we've got 20 reasons, and then we've got 8 reasons provided in the motion for summary judgment. Now we're focusing really on this alleged lie, which again, the trial court said was evidence of dishonesty without really getting into the other interpretation. My client's interpretation was simply a slip of the tongue. But I want to contrast that with the undisputed facts that Mr. Wright said on 2 different occasions to the EEOC that individuals both over 40 and under 40 held the assistant lab tech position. Now, that is undeniably false. No one over 40 has ever held the assistant lab tech position. Now, Mr. Wright said, well, that was simply a slip of the tongue, or that, excuse me, that was just simply an innocent mistake. Well, a jury might conclude that, but a jury might also conclude that Mr. Wright, who has 30 years' experience in human resources, would know that it would be very beneficial to him to paint a picture to the EEOC, the federal agency investigating the case, that over individuals both in a protected class and outside the protected class held this position. Now, the trial court just, you know, it said essentially, it discounted that, it said essentially that, well, it's just a mistake. Well, there is this other interpretation, and that's very powerful evidence of discrimination in cases like this, because discrimination cases rarely have a smoking gun. They're small pieces of circumstantial evidence collected together. And so just as Reese versus Sanderson, the Supreme Court recognized that if the employer is dishonest about the reasons why they decided to take an employment action, a reasonable fact finder conclude that that is affirmative evidence of guilt, that there wouldn't be any other reason to hide something if you had a really strong justification for making your employment decision that wasn't based on an age bias. And then finally, I want to talk about what one commenter said was the slicing and dicing that occurs in these employment cases. And the trial court really did that here on a couple of occasions. And by slicing and dicing, segregating each piece of information, saying that alone isn't enough to make a prima facie, or not enough to establish pretext. The trial court did that with the falsehoods to the EEOC, and he did it with the age-related mark made during the interview, both times saying that that alone wasn't enough to defeat summary judgment. Well, I submit that the trial court fell into the trap that all the courts said you can't do, and then that is you have to look at the evidence in its totality. You can't segregate the evidence, because no one is going in this day and age, rarely does someone say, I'm discriminating because of age. So you have to look at the circumstantial evidence. And when you say, this one alone, you're really looking for that smoking gun, which the courts uniformly do not require. So unless there's any other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michael Santo. My bar registration number is 24083, and I represent CAPCO. And CAPCO representative Dan Wright is in the courtroom as well. This case concerns a company's effort to hire the most qualified person for the job using lawful bases. What are those? Veracity, qualifications. Qualifications that the company needs to perform the position. That's what CAPCO did in this situation, and because of that, we request that this court affirm the district court's ruling that dismissed Mr. Garcia's claim because he could not establish that there was pretext in the hiring decision. The Supreme Court in Reeves explained, and Mr. Asbell addressed this in his opening, the issue, the ultimate issue, is whether the employer intentionally discriminated. Proof that the employer's pro-offered reason is unpersuasive or even obviously contrived does not necessarily establish that. In other words, it is not enough to disbelieve CAPCO. The court, on top of that, has to believe Garcia that intentional discrimination occurred in this matter. In sum, if an employer undertakes actions based upon reasonable factors other than the applicant age, then the adverse action does not violate the law. Well, what are those reasons? First reason, Mr. Wright thought Mr. Garcia lied in his application, in his interview. He based that on objective facts. He had seen the organization that Mr. Garcia said he was laid off from advertising for positions. Based upon those objective facts, Mr. Wright thought he lied.
Could you address the argument that reason was not provided in the explanation given to the EEOC?
It was actually provided in the second response provided to the EEOC. Number 10, it states in there, with Mr. Wright, which would be record of transcript 629 and 630, number 10, the specific wording of that is, it seemed unlikely that Garcia left PCP due to lack of work. PCP was the organization they were talking about at the time.
Right, Mr. Santo, let me just follow up with that a little bit. So there were two responses to the EEOC.
There were.
So were there a list of reasons provided in the first response?
There were a number of reasons provided in the first. It is undisputed that that reason was not provided in the first.
All right, but it was then provided in the second response?
It was.
Okay, and was there a reason given why it did not appear in the first response?
That has not come in during discovery, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Asbell also frequently, as long as we're talking about the second response, Mr. Asbell frequently mentions, well, there are 20 responses, 20 different reasons, and there were only 8 in the first. 629 and 630, the record of transcript that has that submission by CAPCO, does not have 20 reasons. In fact, what Mr. Wright did is he identified in his intro paragraph, I do not believe CAPCO discriminated against Mr. Garcia based on his age for the following reasons. The first two discussed the questions he asked, where he looked for those questions, that he had accessed those questions on the Society for Human Resource Management's website. That didn't go to why he decided not to hire Mr. Garcia. That went to why he thought the organization had not violated the law. Additionally, number three, which is in there, he concerns in Mr. Wright's belief that Mr. Garcia did not discuss his chemistry background. This was provided in one of the eight. Provided summary judgment as well. Mr. Wright thought it was odd that Mr. Garcia didn't discuss his most relevant experience. Another reason that's been identified. Mr. Wright's belief that Garcia's chemistry experience was unrelated. He thought the other candidate, Mr. Woolsey, had more related chemistry experience. Chemistry experience for Mr. Garcia was more than a decade old. That was provided as one of the reasons. He discussed the industrial nature of the work location. Mr. Woolsey had worked recently in an industrial location. Mr. Garcia had worked in an office environment. Based upon work history, Mr. Wright didn't think Mr. Garcia would stay very long. This was based upon Mr. Wright's 30 years experience in finding that employees who leave supervisory positions and are then hired into non-supervisory positions don't stay very long. Recent work experience of Mr. Garcia was unrelated, according to Mr. Wright's belief. It seemed unlikely that Garcia left the point 10. And then point 12 and 13 again discuss Mr. Wright's belief with respect to Mr. Garcia's work history. The remaining ones discuss closing statements, discusses how many CAPCO, the breakdown of age in CAPCO's employees. The final one is that Mr. Wright identifying that CAPCO had never received during his entire 30-year career that EEOC charge. So these weren't, the plaintiff continually looks at these, well, these are 20 reasons why they didn't hire Mr. Garcia. Well, that's not true. Most of these reasons have nothing to do with the hiring decision. They're simply CAPCO statements in the EEOC position statement as to why there wasn't age discrimination present here.
Mr. Santo, can you address the issue of the shifting explanations? Because as you were stating earlier, there were some reasons provided in a second response that were not provided in the first response to the EEOC.
The only one that I'm aware of, Your Honor, that was that way would be the one misstatement by Mr. Garcia during the interview as to why Mr. Garcia or Mr. Wright did not identify that to the EEOC. I'm not aware. But the other reasons were identified and have been identified throughout discovery as the reasons for the decision.
All right. Could you also address the argument that was just made by Mr. Asbell about the stray remark doctrine?
Well, the stray remark doctrine goes to, Your Honor, initially, as pointed out by Judge Rottenberg, the issue of the stray remark isn't necessarily related to age. More people are in high school, they don't have to be a certain age. You can go through high school at a much later age. And so it's not necessarily related to someone's age. It's not been alleged by Mr. Garcia that Mr. Wright said, well, this person has to be under 18. According to Mr. Garcia, Mr. Wright denies this, but according to Mr. Garcia, he simply said, this is intended for someone in high school. Additionally, the cases, and for example, one of the cases we cited, Tabor versus Hilty, it doesn't go to the ultimate issue. Even to the extent it was made, it's just a general statement. Statements by decision makers during an interview expressing discriminatory beliefs about whether members of the protected class are capable of doing the job. That's what would be a potentially a concern here. For example, in that Tabor case, the hiring supervisor explicitly stated a view that women have inferior knowledge of tools and inferior ability to sell tools. These statements spoke directly to the central requirements for the job for which the plaintiff was applying. Directly to the job, directly about a discriminatory statement toward that individual's protected classification. This, to the extent it occurred, and as we identified in discovery, the resume requires a high school degree. So to say the position had to be filled, we were looking for someone in high school, it just can't make any sense. Additionally, Kepco has never hired anyone in high school, and to hire someone in high school would probably violate child labor laws because these individuals are working with heavy machinery. But that being said, the statement does not go to the central, a discriminatory belief as to the performance of a central job duty. It's simply, to the extent claimed by Mr. Garcia, an innocuous statement. Another point raised by the plaintiff in their, or Mr. Garcia in his opening statement, was this, well, Wright didn't ask any follow-up questions. How come there weren't anything on the resume? How come he didn't? This is the shoulda, woulda, coulda argument. And in short, that's not what's required. As John Arillo explains, courts are not super personnel departments looking into what an employer should have done, what an employer could have done. Instead, courts are to determine whether or not there is intentional discrimination. Not simply, could Mr. Wright have done a better job? Could he have followed up in the interview? Could he have written this down? Sure, he could have, but it's not a violation of the law not to identify that. A couple points I wanted to address in particular from appellant's opening brief. With the probable cause finding. He said, well, there's a probable cause finding by the EEOC. That alone must equal pretext. Well, there are numerous, first of all, the case cited by Mr. Garcia in his brief is simply a probative evidence in terms of can that be admitted during trial, not whether or not it goes to the issue of pretext. The Smith case he cited was a trial case and whether it could be submitted. There are numerous cases, for example, Mongero versus Salt River Project, which is a Ninth Circuit case, that said even an admissible EEOC report is not a free pass through summary judgment. The EEOC probable cause standard, by its definition, is a lower standard than pretext. And so simply because Mr. Garcia at some point obtained a probable cause finding does not necessarily mean that there's pretext. Another issue that has come up in Mr. Garcia's argument is this honest belief doctrine. Mr. Wright and Mr. Garcia was unable to explain any basis for a statement that he did not, let me back up, Mr. Garcia was never able to provide any testimony that Mr. Wright did not honestly believe these reasons. Mr. Garcia has said, well, that can't be the standard. We can't do that. And he's pulled Seventh Circuit cases and Eighth Circuit and Second Circuit, but we've overlooked the Tenth Circuit. And remember, this is also, in addition to a state law claim, there is a federal law, Age Discrimination and Employment Act claim in this matter. And in that case, in the Tenth Circuit, in a Colorado Court of Appeals case, in the Tenth Circuit case in Colorado, Rivera versus City and County, the court stated the relevant inquiry is not whether the employer's proffered reason were wise, fair, or correct, but whether it honestly believed those reasons and acted in good faith upon those beliefs. And then they cited Bullington. That is a Tenth Circuit opinion on point with respect to the honest belief doctrine. Now, appellant Mr. Garcia has also claimed, well, if that were taken, that would rule out pretext discussion. If you said honest belief, that's the end. Rivera addresses that. Rivera goes on to say, well, nevertheless, even though there's this honest belief, pretext can still be shown by weaknesses, implausibilities, incoherencies in the employer's proffered legitimate basis. So in this case, 10th Circuit law, case law, states the honest belief doctrine still has pretext to deal with.
I'm not even sure the Narcolex case supports your opponent. Did you want to comment? When I read the narcolepsy case, that's the Sixth or Seventh Circuit, mm-hmm. where the gentleman was falling asleep in his car. He got hired, and then there was a question of whether he actually had that diagnosis, and he wrote no, he didn't, and they fired him for lying. Do you remember that?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not pulling that one up from my memory bank as quickly as I would like.
I'll ask your opponent, because it was confusing to me how that helped Mr. Garcia. And frankly, some of the cases seem to be confusing, even about the honest belief, even where they differ.
There are certainly a number of opinions that question the use of the honest belief and then come back and use the honest belief. I think the case that was initially cited by the plaintiff, Mr. Garcia, I'm now blanking on that case, but the initial case on that issue discusses, we're not really sure, we love this doctrine, we see some problems in it, but then turned around and addressed it under the honest belief.
All right, Mr. Santa, let me ask you one other question. Sure. All right, Mr. Asbell is discussing the slice and dice issue, and it is undisputed from the record that at least on two occasions that the trial court here did say this reason alone is not enough. So I would like you to address that and the propriety of the court in doing that.
I think the court looked at the totality of the circumstances. For example, the honest belief comes up in the opinion on page 8. And then the judge goes through the other issues addressed by Mr. Garcia, the qualifications. He goes through the lie. He goes through the joke about being conducting the interview in the janitor's closet. He discusses the typographical letter. He went through all these issues, and at the end of the day, still said, I don't see pretext here. Based upon, I did want to thank Your Honor for the question, but I did want to address the submission and Mr. Asbell's statement that there was a lie. There wasn't a lie. Mr. Wright responded to the request by identifying these are the employees who performed this position in the past. Did they have the title of administrative assistant lab tech? No, but they performed those positions. And so for this reason, we would request that the court affirm the ruling of the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Asbell, you have about 2 minutes and 50 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just direct the court's attention to the record. That's the second EEO response dated March 7, 2001, number 9. The assistant lab tech position listing follows, and then it has names. Jamie Barker, 46. Cody Woolsey, 30. Jesse Picazzo, 22. Doesn't say the position, the individuals who did the same job duties as the assistant lab tech position. It says that these people held that position. That's undisputably false. Maybe it's an innocent mistake, but a reasonable fact finder could conclude it was intentional misrepresentation, which Reeves versus Sanderson discussed as a way, as affirmative evidence of discrimination. Finally, another point. My colleague says, well, the 10th Circuit case on point regarding the honest belief doctrine. This court isn't bound by the 10th Circuit. I addressed the court to the Colorado Civil Rights Commission versus Big O Tire, 940 P2D 397. This court said that it's only bound by the pronouncements of the United States Supreme Court in applying federal law. It's not bound by the 10th Circuit.
I agree with that point. Could we turn to the narcolepsy case and explain, if you will, how that helps you?
Sure, Your Honor. In the narcolepsy case, that was the Seventh Circuit case. I have it here. If you just give me a second.
Again, that's where the diagnosis was murky about the guy.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Your Honor. That's a Sixth Circuit case, Smith versus Chrysler. That case rejected the Seventh Circuit's pronouncement the Seventh Circuit said, well, we're not going to get into whether the reasons were right or not. We're just going to take the honest belief. And the reason why we cited that case is because the Sixth Circuit says, wait a second, that would circumvent really the law of discrimination. It can't really be based on stereotypes and age. We
A fact finder can conclude from, if the reason was so flimsy, that it was such a bad reason given, that it really wasn't honestly held. And so that's why we cited
Allen. I see.
And, you know, there's also evidence that you talked about the honest belief doctrine previously, but I would only say that there are two things that really take this case out of the honest belief realm, or that a reasonable fact finder at least concluded that there wasn't, that Wright didn't honestly believe these 20-some reasons why he said there was no age discrimination. And that, again, is the age-related statement, which must be taken as an age-related statement in summary judgment, because a reasonable fact finder concluded that he didn't really care about the qualifications. He wasn't looking at the qualifications. What he was looking at is whether he was old enough or not for this position. And secondly, my time is up. So I'd urge the court to reverse remand so this case can proceed to trial. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. I thank counsel for their excellent argument.